Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
Welcome to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with none other than Tom McDonald. Tom McDonald,
hello.
America's tallest Catholic radio co-host, author of a blog at the National Catholic Register, which we're going to be discussing a little bit later on. Connoisseur of all things mystic, strange, and arcane. A veritable a walking 40 times for Catholics.
I guess if you're going to have a reputation for something, I guess that's not a bad one. I guess it's better than being the crazy woman who shouts at Pope Francis from the pages of the Remnant. Wait, did I mention somebody?
Yes. Yeah,
I'm so old. I remember when trads were completely barking mad, and I was one of them.
Yep. Yeah, it's harder and harder to. I never had a lot of empathy for that kind of stuff, but man, I don't. You know, there's just something. It must be his cologne or something. I don't know. I guess. No, I guess. I guess Benedict was the one with cologne.
Get it? He was German. He was a bishop there. Cologne. Obscure Catholic humor.
It was a humor concept of funniness. But, I don't know. Maybe it's the garlic in his Italian cooking or whatever it is. Francis just has this ability to send one demographic in the church around the bend repeatedly. And so we're now living in an age where on this Super Tuesday, real Catholics are springing to the defense of a guy like Donald Trump.
He just laughed. You can't even say it without laughing, can you?
And wagging their fingers at Pope Francis because he's making anti-Catholics mad at us. And he's the real villain here.
Yeah, there was something in the Federalist there, right, about he's going to give a rise to the know-nothings or something.
Yes,
you know, because of these meddling kids. I couldn't quite find the logic of it. It's like, you know, because we're meddling in politics. And once I start saying that,
the church has never, ever done before.
I start to remember, Innocent III and everybody else up until the 19th century.
It's kind of, you know,
we've never done that.
Part of the church's job is to, in fact, meddle in politics. You know, when you state the gospel, one of the things that you will do is make enemies. But the strangest part of it right now is living in an age when the greatest Catholics of all time are the ones who hate the Pope and hate the church more than anybody else. They just hate this guy. I mean, there was a piece yesterday by a particularly unhinged woman, you know, which I didn't see the piece because I don't read the magazine that publishes it. She is reliably crazy. And I was instantly inspired by this piece. I was getting hate mail from people who were saying that they were looking forward to Francis's papacy ending soon and suddenly.
Ooh, wow. That actually is one of the hellbound things you can actually say. Praying for the death of the Pope is one of those
things.
Oh,
he wasn't praying for the... You're totally putting words in his mouth. He never said that he was praying for the death of the Pope or anything like that. And it's like... Do you guys even listen to yourself? So, you know, it's a weird and you kind of have to laugh about it, time to be alive, when Donald Trump is apparently our real savior the vicar of Christ, the successor of Peter. He's the enemy that the church needs to fear. He's the greatest threat that the church faces today. Well, it's a crazy time.
I read that piece you're talking about, by the way, and what it said was the Pope needs to be deposed and anathematized.
Yeah, well,
that actually was published in an actual publication that had an actual reputation up until the moment it published that piece. you know, in which case that entire publication, well, it's a contained. It's the Remnant. It was a tratty thing, and they were they're a little bit wacky, you know, kind of like the Wanderer and the
now they're a lot wacky.
And on the right, but, like on the left, they have the Tablet and they're in the National Catholic Reporter. They're all a little bit nuts because they've they all hove to one side or the other. But that was basically crazy. Saying that the bishops need to depose the Pope.
That's a smart idea.
That's saying,
perhaps
that's
perhaps they can replace it with. They can replace him with three popes.
That's right. Yeah.
It's been done before. It's part of our tradition.
You know?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's pretty kooky. And, but, you know, so here it is on Super Tuesday. And, you know, something I just keep banging away at is try getting your thinking about the world not from our political categories here in the United States. Because, you know, if you hadn't noticed, especially this year, our political categories are completely insane. Try thinking with the church instead. And when you do that, you know, for one thing, things become, they become a lot funnier. As you watch these kinds of things unspooling. But in addition, you know, as you think with the church, get out and vote, especially today if you're
really
in one of the Super
that,
Tuesday
actually?
States.
Can I?
Well, yeah. You could be the dissenting.
Can I be the Dan Aykroyd to your Jane Curtin on this one? Is that a dated reference?
Boy, are you old.
Yeah, I have to. I don't know that voting is a solution. I mean, these are primaries. Both of these parties are objectively evil. Maybe in the general election, if you can write in somebody, but if the primaries are basically choosing between, you know, Hillary and Bernie, and I can't believe I'm saying that, and Donald and Rubio Cruz, we really have got there's five people. There's nothing there.
Well, you can still, you know what you can do, and this is again something I bang away at a great deal, is you can vote to try to lessen evil. Don't vote for the lesser of two evils. What's the difference, Mark?
Can you explain that to us?
Yeah. The when you're faced with candidates who support all kinds of grave evils, what you can try to do is lessen the impact of evil. That is a legitimate thing to do as a voter. And one of the things you can do primaries are reducing valves. Primaries are for weeding out, hopefully, the worst of the candidates.
Right, but they're not fulfilling that purpose anymore.
Well, but, you know, you could still, if you can get rid of the immense menace that is Donald Trump, then that's not a bad thing. You're still going to be stuck with Cruz or Rubio, but at least you won't have a dangerous demagogic narcissist with his finger on the nuclear arsenal of the greatest power in the history of the world. That's not a bad day's work if you can stop that guy. Doesn't mean you know. You haven't voted for anything there. What you've done is you've stopped at least one danger to the world. So, you know, I would urge people to get out there and vote. And by the way, I got the catechism on my side for this. The church also says that we should be voting. So I win.
Should be voting. Yeah. Now, I'm not so sure, because what's happening now is people are making their peace with Trump. And you have to look at that and say, what does that mean? Do they think they can
all
control?
All the more reason. All the more reason to get out and vote. Well, I know they did this stuff in 1933, too. We'll be able to control him.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, I don't know if you watched Downton Abbey, by the way, but they had a walk-on from Neville Chamberlain. And it was very sly. It was very subtle, but he was a character. So I can't see him taking sides in anything or something like that was what they said. And I'm like, yeah, this actually didn't end bad. Because it's, you know, written by Julian Fellowes, who's a conservative Catholic. And that's kind of... You know, I understand wanting to resist, you know, being the next Neville Chamberlain and say, well, we can deal with Donald Trump. But you see, people are making their peace. My governor, Chris Christie, has now endorsed him. And, you know, we actually had some fondness for him because he had done some decent things in the state. But that's just, you look at it and say, you know, what's going on in your head? So these people are making peace with the possibility of President Trump.
Yeah. I know, you know, I'm watching Christians go for this, and my response is, this is not what Jesus meant by welcoming prostitutes. don't do this, right? This is bad. And, so anyway, I'm watching this spectacle on spool in front of me, you know, and you think to yourself, this is actually a date in American history that may very well be remembered for a very, very long time.
Yeah, that's what Rod Dreher said today, was he thinks this Super Tuesday will mark the end of two-party politics, or at least the GOP, or something to that effect. Well, I think it's probably true.
If it marks the end of the GOP, that wouldn't be such a terrible thing. It's just that something needs to arise in its place.
Sure.
And that was one of the weird things yesterday, was hearing the GOP saying, if Trump wins, we're going to run a third party candidate. It's like, you've just conceded that you have been reduced to a third party?
Right.
Okay, you know. Yeah. What are you going to call it? The Whigs? I mean, we'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. And we're here today with the brilliant, the effervescent Tom McDonald. And we'll be back right after this.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We are here today with Tom McDonald. We've been chuckling because we cannot cry.
Because strange things are happening in our country. And strange. What is a Catholic to do? Mark says we should engage the process to lessen the possibility of evil. I think sometimes you have to drain the wound.
draining the wound will happen of its own accord. All I'm saying is, you know, the Hippocratic Oath says first do no harm.
True.
And the primary really is a place where you can vote in order to lessen evil. You're not voting. You're not yet committing to vote for anybody. You're just doing what you can to destroy those that need destroyed.
But I think we know what the results from this will be. And I don't know really what to think. I think it says that we're very... I understand Trump. I'm saying it myself. I understand the appeal among some people more than I did in August when I thought this was a novelty candidacy to help him pump his next show. I thought this would burn out by September.
We all thought that.
Yeah.
John Oliver the other night said that Donald Trump is the worrisome back mole on the...
You can't ignore it anymore.
It was there last summer. It was kind of dark and weird looking, but now it's like 3 inches across and you're starting to really think, wait a minute, this isn't going away.
That's right. You've got to deal with this. And, no, I just... When you listen to the people themselves. And what we have to remember is there's people, many of them, sadly, Christian and Catholic, at the base of the support. You have to kind of listen to what they say. And I've been listening. And the first thing I get is that they're conned to some degree, that they've fallen for an illusion of his success, which it doesn't actually exist. He's not a success. His brand is a success at, you know, he's a success at making you think he's successful, not at the things he is himself. I mean, anybody who lives in New Jersey knows about the casinos and everything else that had serious financial trouble. Right. And if you wanted to get people not to vote for Trump, I could wheel you into the Trump Taj 40 minutes from my house and you'd like, I don't even know if that's there anymore.
Yeah.
But, you know, especially the middle class, the working class, especially the white male. White males white middle-aged males are the highest risk of suicide now, I believe, and have shown the highest increase in suicides now because we believe that we're at there's no future for us in this country, that mm-hmm. something's been taken and something broke, something's broken. And, you know, this is when something breaks, when a toy breaks as a child, and it's, I don't mean to infantilize the supporters, but when something like that happens, you react in anger,
right?
You know, and there's a certain amount of anger fueling some of this. So it's a combination of low information voters and rationally angry voters who have something real to be angry about. And the thing is, these are the people betrayed by the GOP. You know, my first vote was cast for Dukakis, and all the rest of them up until recently were cast for libertarians. I've had this rightward drift my whole life. And I would be a natural member of the GOP, but both my faith and my conscience would never allow me to be a part of the Republican Party. I can't stand them and what they've done and what they support. Mm-hmm. You know, and when you see someone like Cruz, who might have seemed like a rational candidate, saying that line about he wants to see if he can bomb them enough so the sand will glow. You know,
good Lord. Yeah.
A person can't look at that and say this is a party of responsibility. So then what do? You go to the guy who you know, who's the howl of rage, the Whitman-esque yelp.
barbaric yawp.
His barbaric yawp of American rage. And he's like compressed zeitgeist or something. I don't know.
It is the classic way that a demagogue works, of course.
Of course.
You are a great people.
Right.
And you have fallen on misfortune through no fault of your own. Shadowy forces of evil have conspired against us, and I will, because I am a great man,
right?
I will, you know, bring deliverance to you. Just invest in me all of your fury and your rage, and I will take away any sense of responsibility that you have. Right. Together, you know, we shall again have the greatness that is rightfully ours, that has been taken from us by, you know, minorities and filthy, disgusting women who are pigs and dogs, you know, this kind of stuff. You just think, good Lord. And people are so eager to hear that. I mean, the one true thing that he said was he could stand in the middle of Fifth Avenue and shoot people and he wouldn't lose their votes. And that, unfortunately, is true, you know?
Absolutely true. Yeah.
And his followers have shown it. I mean, they will put up with anything that he says. And more than put up with it. I mean, these things are features. They're not bugs. You know, and you watch his rallies where they're beating up people. You know, some black guy shows up at a rally and they beat the tar out of him and you can hear people shouting, Sieg Heil.
Yeesh.
You know,
well, yeah, he wasn't he reluctant to like distance himself from the Klan recently?
Yeah, I mean, Muslims, they're evil. Mexicans, they're evil. The KKK, well, let's not rush to judgment here. You know, you know, and you know, for me, you know, since this show is about looking at the world from a Catholic perspective, there is no way that is reconcilable with our faith as Catholics. You can't, you know, if you bend that bar, if you bend me that far, I'll break, you know. And so you have to look at these, you know, you look at something like this and you say, well, in a primary, I look at it and I think, this would be the excellent time to use the primary as a reducing valve to, no, you're not going to fix everything about this election, but you will at least get rid of that guy. Right. If you go out and vote against him, vote for anybody else, you know, other than him. But I don't think that's going to happen. I think he's going to walk away with this primary, and I think that Hillary will walk. I hope to be surprised. You know, I've been wrong before. I was the guy that said The Passion of the Christ. Who's going to see that movie?
Yeah, I know.
You know, who's going to go watch a movie in three dead languages about a man being tortured to death? Nobody's going to see that movie. Well, what did I know? You know, it's the number 7 best-selling movie of all time, and so I could be wrong. You know, maybe he's going to he's going to get his head handed to him today, but. I think not, unfortunately. So we're going to be stuck.
All the signs are showing. And, you know, there is – Hillary is one indictment away from sweeping him into office. She actually – you know, the FBI is apparently getting extremely upset that they will be forbidden from launching actual indictments because they've been doing serious investigations. And there's multiple levels of crime she's committed in terms of official secrets and things.
The great thing about our system, though, is if she's elected, she can grant herself a presidential pardon.
I mean, why didn't Nixon think of that? You know, there's things here that Nixon would be, if he was alive, he'd be like, whoa, people, you can't do that. You know, Nixon was Cicero, you know, compared to...
Yeah. Yeah, somebody was showing me, you know, somebody was reminding me of, like, Nixon's record. And it was like...
It's quite good.
Yeah, and it was like, man, you know, they would... That guy would be indicted by the GOP as a communist today, and
so would Reagan. I mean,
so would Reagan. Yeah.
You know, if you look at some of the debates, you know, between for the second, I think for the second election when he was debating Bush and them talking about securing the border and all these things, neither Reagan nor Bush were having any of it. You know. Reagan saw everything from a Cold War perspective, reasonably so, and believed that there was a certain amount. He called it a pressure valve in letting immigrants into the country from Mexico because it prevented that country at its worst from perhaps exploding and turning into another Cuba. You know, that
interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. That was his main concern. He says, if we don't give these people a place to flee to, then we might see another situation like Cuba. And there was never, you know, and this was Bush Sr. There was never any sense that either of them wanted to necessarily persecute or do any of this nativist stuff that we're seeing now, any of this kind of semi know nothing thing we're seeing. And now that's what some of these Catholic writers are saying. We're going to see the rise of the know-nothings again. I'm like, could it get worse? I mean, we already are. You know?
I was going to say, you're already seeing the rise of the know-nothings. You know, and that's the thing is, it's one of those things where, you know, like this article that you're reading in the Federalist today by Maureen Malarkey was, you know, warning against the rise of the know-nothings because of this Pope. But it was all very much written in that sort of, you know, oh, isn't it deliciously awful?
It's like the Grinch wrote it.
Wouldn't that be terrible? You know, and it's like, actually, it would be terrible, but you're not sorry about it. You know, you just... despise this Pope. Well, anyway, enough of... let us speak of better things.
Let us speak of better things, but not before the break.
When we return from the break, you're written a piece on Gus.
Gus, as
Augie.
We call us in the know. Augie.
Augie. St. Augustine. Not Augie Doggy, not Augie Ben Doggy, but St. Augustine. And so I'd like to, when we come back...
about St. Augustine. It's
like... spent a little time talking about St. Augustine.
Yeah.
One of the most brilliant men who ever lived, a great saint, and we will be back with Tom McDonald to talk about him right after this. Mm-hmm.
Fox Media invites you to Bless the Yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit breadboxmedia.com.
And welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea, and we are here today with Tom McDonald. By the way, if you want to join the conversation, give us a call at 1-573-4-BREAD-4. 1-573-4-BREAD-4. And you can also, of course, you can call, you can tweet us at Breadbox Media. So feel free to contact us with all of your comments, questions, rebukes, praise. Please send your rebukes to Tom McDonald. Send me all of your praise. That'd be great. So
yeah, that'd be great.
That'd be great. So anyway, Augustine writes about creation. He writes a commentary on Genesis.
He wrote three, actually. It was a subject that really worked on that fine brain, and I do think he was one of the finest minds that ever lived. You know, when you look at Thomas, you have a more systematic approach. Mm-hmm. You know, a more rational Aristotelian approach. When you look at Augustine, you get I don't want this to sound like it's about to sound, but he has a more human face than we generally attribute to Thomas. Thomas, of course, wrote beautiful hymns and was, you know, equally warm and cuddly. And there's plenty of fine anecdotes about Thomas's humanity. But when you see Augustine, you actually see a Christian early on. Mm-hmm. In the whole line of things, really wrestling with ideas and wrestling with them in public and going back as in the Retractiones and going back and say, boy, I screwed that one up. Oh, man.
Well, you know, yeah, it's interesting because Augustine lives, of course, in a time before the seven great ecumenical councils have been held. There's already been a couple by his time. And a couple, when does he die? I think he dies before the Council of Ephesus, right?
420s? Yeesh.
Now I know. So he dies before the Nestorian heresy works that. So the point is this.
His main problem was the Donatists, which, you know, as heresies go, you know, it's not that bad. They're basically kind of proto-Jansenists.
Well, and Pelagians. And he's also arguing with Pelagians.
Yeah.
And just for background. So what you got going on in the early history of the church, that is, in particular, I'm speaking here of the seven ecumenical councils that take place, which are held to settle big questions. And before those questions are settled, what you got are fathers of the church who are at one and the same time conserving but also developing the tradition that's been handed down to them. So asking, you know, what are the implications of what we believe?
Right.
And Augustine is a guy who, more than anybody else, I think, practically in all of antiquity, wears his heart and his brain on his sleeve.
Absolutely.
While he's struggling with all of this stuff. It's intensely personal for him. So he literally invents the entire genre of confessional literature.
Yes.
Where he just invents it. Nobody had ever done anything like this before. He sits down and basically makes, in his brilliant book, The Confessions, he invents this autobiography in which instead of, you know, I am Ozymandias, the greatest person who's ever lived. Instead, he just stands before God in all of his nakedness and tells God everything he's ever done wrong, and praises God for everything that has ever happened to him that was good.
Right. And in a beautiful prose style, elegant in Latin, and translates very well, but very. Yeah. A real heart of a poet and an intellectual, which was a rare combination.
Right. Yeah. So, you know, just a magnificent mind who's really struggling with things. He's trying hard to understand things because no one's worked this stuff out. Part of what the tradition itself will do is look to Augustine as he struggles through this stuff. Sometimes he'll get things right.
Right.
So he'll have this huge argument with a guy named Pelagius about a question that almost nobody in the modern world ever thinks about at all.
Right.
And the question was, are we sinners because we sin, or do we sin because we're sinners?
Right. And to make that less cryptic.
Right. It seems like such a weird question. You know, Pelagius is a guy who says, we're sinners because we sin. And the implication of that is, so just knock it off.
Right. And we can do that all on our own.
Yeah, just grit your teeth real hard and don't ever sin again. Jesus came as a model to show you how to live, and that's all Jesus did. He lived a perfect life, and he did it, so can you. So stop sinning.
Right. He rejected the whole idea of grace and divine
right.
aid. I mean,
right.
Which is a stunning thing when you look back, because we take it so for granted now,
right.
this whole action of grace and how it works on the individual human soul. But also when we look at any of the patristics, and one thing you learn when you study patristics, and I really would urge it, because when you read the early fathers, you find incredible minds wrestling at incredible times with incredible ideas. But the thing that defined the faith, the things that create doctrine, is heresy. And people don't tend to really appreciate that relationship between heresy and doctrine. Every new development in doctrine was a reaction to a heresy, okay? So the Trinity grew out of the Arians. Our understanding of the natures of Christ grew out of these things.
Right.
Not that the truth of them did. People need to be real clear on this. It's like, why isn't this articulated right in the Acts of the Apostles? Like, well, because nobody was debating it then, because they knew what they were talking about. You know, they just didn't have the language necessarily. And when somebody says X is Y, when somebody says Jesus is a creature, as Arius would say, then the fathers would kind of pull their chins and say, that doesn't sound right.
Exactly it. And so, you know, in Augustine's day, Augustine has various controversies, but this is a particularly important one, because what will come out of it will be some really good things. So this is it's Augustine who gives you original sin. Well, okay, Adam gave you original sin, but it's Augustine who really formulates this idea that there's something wrong with us. Paul will vaguely say that we have sinned in Adam. And in the early church, that was kind of enough. The reason that we need the grace of Jesus is because we have sinned in Adam. What Augustine's really going to do is spell out for us that original sin, it doesn't mean if your father was a horse thief, you're a horse thief.
Right.
That's not what it means. What it means is that when Adam and Eve rebelled against God, when our first parents rebelled against God, they didn't just lose the life of God for themselves, they lost it for all of us.
Right.
So it's like a spiritual birth defect. There's something wrong with us. Now, sometimes Augustine, when he talks about this, will say it in ways where he's saying exactly the same thing, but he says it in such a poetic way that we respond to it with this intense sense of longing. When he says, you have made us for yourself, O Lord, and our hearts are restless until they rest in you. People's hearts leap up when they hear something like that.
Sure.
But what's he saying? Well, why are our hearts restless? Because we're fallen creatures, because we suffer right. from original sin. And so he insists on the necessity of grace to save us. And this is absolutely Catholic. This is deeply Catholic. He will then go on and start, as is his custom, he will speculate on what some of the consequences of this are. And some of his speculations are things that the church will, in fact, go on to condemn. The idea of double eternal predestination, which is, the Calvinists are going to run with that one.
Oh, yeah.
And say, you know, well, there are just some people that God has just made to damn. You know, the church is going to say, that don't sound right.
Right.
And but, you know, that's part of the thing about being a pioneering genius is, you know, you're even Michael Jordan misses layups sometimes.
Sure. Right. And if you look at the early fathers, you'll see Clement and Irenaeus and some of the others are in terms of grace, are clearly coming down in Pelagian territory.
Right.
In the general area of it, basically. Right. And what it is, it's extolling free will above all else, that we can muscle our way into goodness and salvation without, you know, preventing a grace or any of the other graces that, you know, that
right.
Because we were created, and it's not an unreasonable theory, because we were right. divinely created and we have that spark left.
Right.
From the creation, but rather we believe that it's restored in Christ and in baptism and through the ongoing work of God. Right. You know, and some of these things, even the most brilliant minds had peculiar ideas about creation in Genesis. And Augustine was very influenced by Origen, but Origen believed that when the creation accounts say God clothed us in skins, that was us receiving our flesh. That was his interpretation. Yeah.
Okay. That's curious. Okay.
Yeah, but we don't buy that now. We don't think, we had flesh in Eden. You know, it was perfected right. flesh, and we understand it better now. But Origen was just, you know, he wrote a lot. He was coming up with ideas and what this. And so, you know, God clothing us was giving us our physical bodies and sending us into the world. So,
interesting.
We don't believe that, just to be right. clear. In case anybody's thinking that sounds like a great idea, no.
But that's the thing is, well, we'll talk about this when we come back from the break, is when you're dealing with people who are thinking this stuff through for the first time, sometimes they're going to be brilliant, sometimes not. We'll be back right after this. You're listening to Connecting the Dots. We're here with Tom McDonald, and we're on Redbox Media. Back in a minute.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.
Welcome back to Connecting the Dots. I'm your host, Mark Shea. We're here today with Tom McDonald, and we're talking about Augustine. And we got a little—I got a sidetrack by spending a lot of time on the Pelagian conflict.
No, that's not sidetrack.
Let's talk a little bit about his commentaries on Genesis.
Well, you know, it's really something you actually kind of have to read. My main point in the piece was basically, you know, you ever find these internet atheists, you know, like the guy has the t-shirt, "I'm an atheist, debate me." And, you know, when I was blogging, I used to get them all the time, and we'd get the, "How did God make light before he made the sun?"
Like,
nobody ever considered that question. And did you know there are two creation stories?
No. Get out.
Are you actually joking me? I mean, is this you really think you're one of the bright young stars of logic here, and you're realizing that you're not only asking questions that were asked by Augustine and everyone before him, but you're not even asking good questions. Because if you go to now Augustine did three things on Genesis. He did he used Genesis in a refutation of the Manichees. He started a literal commentary that is now just called the Unfinished Literal Commentary. And then he wrote, really one of his magnum opuses is the literal meaning of Genesis. And it's odd because it's almost never read anymore or translated. I think there's only two current English translations. Okay. But up there with us, the major trinity of his works are De Trinitate, the Trinity, City of God, and Confessions are considered the summit of Augustine. I think literal meaning of Genesis is right up there, because where most exegetes were breaking things down on a line-by-line basis, he was breaking them down on like a word-by-word basis. But he has a litany of questions he asks, and I rephrase them, but it's basically... they're good questions. And the thing in the register today is about questions as kind of the heart of relationships in terms of not just people, but also spiritual relationships. And, you know, Augustine's here firing off questions like, what is meant by heaven and earth? Is it spiritual and material creation? What is the abyss? Is it unformed? Is it formed? Is it matter? Is it not matter? How did God say, here's one that I'm surprised they didn't come up with. How did God say, let there be light, since he has no form and he doesn't produce sound and he had nobody to talk to? So who did he say it? Yeah, so, I mean, these are things he's rattling off, kind of trying to get at the nub of what this incredibly beautiful and complex text. People are afraid of Genesis. I'm not afraid of Genesis. I think Genesis is, you know, the creation accounts are wonderful. And if you go to a homiletic and pastoral review, I wrote an essay on a full theological paper on Ratzinger's approaches to Genesis and how you can use different methods of exegesis to really get at what it means. And the short version of that paper is, we have to remember that those passages of creation in Genesis was not just, they're not isolated.
Right.
They were written after the captivity, probably. Sorry, literalists. That's when they were done.
You mean weren't written 6,000 years ago as eyewitness accounts?
Yeah, no.
On papyrus that had not yet been created by God?
That's right. But they were, but it was ongoing. We come back to creation in the Psalms and Job and Wisdom, and we come back into it right up until the Gospel of John, which suddenly throws back to creation, and then this entire beautiful picture falls into place of the creation of the Word. So when you look at Augustine on creation, you know, when he's talking about, you know, and let there be light, you know, was that sunlight? No, it wasn't sunlight. It was, you know, the light of the Word. It was a spiritual light. And remember, this is called the literal meaning of Genesis. So you have to look, what does Augustine mean by literal? And he doesn't clearly mean what, I don't know, Wilbur Wheatley Boxtop College of Bible study means by literal. He means, what does it mean? What does it actually mean? Not
what is the author trying to say?
Did Fred Flintstone have a dinosaur? You know, is not the main question here.
Well, he did. Duh, I've seen the show.
He had Dino. But, you know, like in the 6 days of creation, he's working out, you know, what are the mornings and evenings? There's no sunlight. So what are they? And he's thinking of it, two different kinds of creation of basically knowledge of creatures and creatures themselves. You know, it's very dense, but it makes sense when Augustine does it, you know. And did God rest? Why would God have to rest? God has no body. What are you talking about with rest? It's we have to avoid this kind of anthropomorphism and this idea of mutability, which he was desperate to say, no, that's not what it meant.
Right.
You know, and God rested from the sense that he rested from producing new things. He stopped producing new nature. And ideas that, like, he embedded the nature of the things in their creation so that they would then move. It's very profoundly contemporary when you read it. You know,
wait a second. You're saying Augustine is suggesting that perhaps embedded in nature, sort of like a rolled up carpet, if you could just unroll that, and by the way, the Latin word for unroll is evolver.
Right.
If you could just unroll that creation over time, then, like, there would be new forms that would emerge out of it, but that's because the seeds of that were already... You know, golly, that reminds me of some theory I remember reading about somewhere. I'm trying to...
You know, and he didn't have the Aristotelian language really to flesh it out that Aquinas would get later on, so that we could talk about essences and we could talk about things, you know, having potentialities built into them. You know, it's very complex and forward-looking stuff. But see, when Augustine tackles these things, there's a quote and you can find it there on National Catholic Register in the right-hand column. The quote is remarkably modern. Somebody actually wrote to me to say that's a real modern quote. I think it was our regular listener, Des.
Thank you, Des.
Whenever non-Christians catch out some members of the Christian community making mistakes on a subject which they know inside out and defending their hollow opinions on the authority of our books, on what grounds are they going to trust those books on the resurrection of the dead and the hope of eternal life in the kingdom of heaven, when they suppose they include any number of mistakes and fallacies on matters which they themselves have been able to master either by experiment or by the surest of calculations? This is Augustine.
Right.
This is like 410, 420. I think he was working on literal meaning
of
Genesis.
Don't say dumb, ignorant things to scientists who know their field, because if you do, they won't listen to you when you talk about
right
the resurrection.
How modern is that quote?
Yeah.
I mean, when you really look at that, that's the nub of the question. So when you look at these trivial questions they're asking, you know, we can't be annoyed that skeptics and materialists and atheists and anti-Christians and just plain doubters and seekers say, well, what about this? Because really, until you've looked at the questions, they're not necessarily dumb questions. You have to say, no, no, there's better questions. You know?
Yes.
There are much better questions. And, you know, in the process of asking the questions, and this is the point I kind of come around to, a question is a way of establishing a relationship in which most people probably aren't aware of because it's not talked about in catechetics too much. Is the actual theological understanding of the Trinity is as relations. You know, the
right.
Trinity is defined by its relations, the relation. It's not three people hanging around in an essence. It's three people related, three persons, sorry. Boy, theological language is extremely precise. You know, the Father related to the Son related to the Holy Spirit related to it, and how they relate. And
right.
That's why the Trinity is defined theologically as three relations. And how do you establish relations and how do you further them? A lot of times through discussion, through discourse, through questions. You know, I talk about the question, why do you love me, to the lover is an unanswerable question most of the time, you know, but it's not a question that's worthless, you know.
Yeah.
You would see some of the folks, some of the more militant online atheists would say, well, you love me because the pheromones were going off and, you know, it has the biological imperative to reproduce the species.
I've seen that love is reduced.
Yeah, it does. I don't remember. I can't remember the guy's name. He's a notorious Ed Fezzer's always taking him apart. He's a notorious internet atheist, but he believes every single phenomenon is reducible to physics, and that includes love. You know,
when you've only got a hammer, every problem looks like a nail.
But
when
you have these things, when you have these questions, you know, creation itself is both a question and an answer. You know, the question is, how do I express love? And the answer is, it's all around you. God had asked himself, how do I express love? You know, it's like his answer to that question couldn't be answered with a simple phrase or a word or a clever thing. It was answered by being written into reality. The creation of reality was his way of answering that question. How do I express love?
Great.
Yeah. And that's kind of the point I try to get at in there was, you know, I don't go too much in Augustinian exegesis because, frankly, you know, that can seem like esoteric stuff. But really the fact that if you query anything, we can't be afraid of those questions. We can't be afraid of querying the text, the fathers, the Pope, anything. And in asking those questions, we come to know the answers and ourselves a little bit better.
It's one of the things that I most deeply appreciated about the Catholic tradition when I became a Catholic was the fact that the Catholic tradition isn't afraid of any questions. You've got people who have asked questions about everything in the world, and they've asked questions about the faith itself. I mean, all the credulity that St. Thomas Aquinas asks is there anything? that's pretty much all he asks of you. Listen, I want to thank you for being on the show today, Tom. You've been listening to Tom McDonald. I'm your host, Mark Shea. You've been listening to Connecting the Dots. Our producer today was Ethan Bolin, and we will be back here on Breadbox Media tomorrow. Bye-bye.
Night whales.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit redboxmedia.com.